to Russia. The fact is that it was the anti-globalization movement that provided this transportation there. But in Spain, an NGO that was closely associated with the Spanish government, that was connected to people who were either currently or previously associated with the United Nations, that were governments from Mali and other places that also attended, that we were paid not just transportation, but we were given honorariums of significance. And it was an international conference. I used the Spanish thing just to show the hypocrisy of the United States government, that seeing that somehow, suddenly, we became agents of a foreign government because we attended a conference in Russia. This is most ridiculous, asinine. And the thing that makes
we're
going
to have to leave it there, Amali. Yeah. Amali Yeshitela, chair of the African People's Socialist Party. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Ear to the streets. Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kbu.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kbu.fm.
Follow KBU on Instagram at KBU Radio. Ear to the streets.
KBU is proud to co-sponsor the Village Building Convergence from June 10th to 18th, 2023. This is an annual community building event bringing together community members and neighborhoods to engage in grassroots placemaking and sustainable community building throughout Portland. More information on how to get involved in this year's Village Building Convergence can be found on the website villagebuildingconvergence.com.
This is KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. Up next, we have the KBOO Evening News, followed at 5:30 by Counterspin.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland climate activists planned a rally against oil transport company Zenith.
Oregon Community College get a funding revamp.
And in national news, former President Donald Trump is indicted for the second time.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 9th, 2023. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Josh Salem. Climate activists in Portland have not given up the fight against oil transport company Zenith Energy. In earlier times, the city was in agreement with activists, denying a permit to Zenith on the grounds that it violated the city's climate goals. Last year, though, city leaders like Commissioners Dan Ryan and Carmen Rubio backpedaled, giving Zenith a permit to run trains full of oil tar through Portland neighborhoods. On Sunday, activists led by the group Mosquito Fleet will gather at Cathedral Park to call on the city council to rescind the permit. They plan to form a fleet of kayaks, canoes, paddleboards, and boats on the Willamette River under the St. John's Bridge as a demonstration. Activists have long cited the explosive danger that a derailment of the oil trains in Portland communities could represent. They also point to the earthquake risk in the region, which could release as much as 193 million gallons of fuel and toxic substances into the environment if tanks fail. Rubio says the city can't make a special process for Zenith's land use permit, but activists are not accepting that as an answer. They're also pressuring the Department of Environmental Quality to deny the permit. Their protest is slated to begin at 11 on Sunday at Cathedral Park.
Oregon is redesigning the way the state distributes money to community colleges. Officials plan to concentrate more on improving outcomes for students from underserved populations. The Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission approved a redesign of the funding formula it uses to administer state money yesterday, after really starting to talk about it early last year. Ben Cannon, the executive director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, said, quote, "For the first time, we are strategically dedicating a proportion of taxpayer funding to improving student success at Oregon's 17 community colleges, while continuing the foundational funding that is focused on getting students in the door and supporting the incredible programs these colleges offer," end quote. Before the redesign, state money was distributed to the colleges according to full-time student enrollment at each college. While enrollment will still be the major focus in the awarding funding, up to 10% in state monies will be distributed to the colleges by weighing the number of underserved students they enroll. Other outcomes, such as completion of certain number of credits or specific courses, will also be important.
The populations the commission considers as underserved include people who come from low-income households, those 25 years of age or older, students in career, technical education, or workforce training programs, and people of color. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission gathered a work group to discuss the changes back in March of 2022. The group was made up of community college administrators, faculty and staff, plus members of the commission and the Oregon Community College Association. According to projections, most colleges will likely see less than a percentage point increase or decrease in the usual amounts they get from the state. Umpqua Community College will take the biggest bump in funding, about $240,000 more, working out to a 1.6% increase. Portland Community College, Oregon's largest, might see the biggest decrease in funding, a loss of more than $240,000, representing a 0.2% decrease. Eric Blumenthal is PCC's Executive Vice President of Administration and Finance. He says the college worked with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to develop the funding model. Blumenthal says the college supports the review of the model that led to the changes and the goal of improving success for underserved students. But he hopes the state also pays attention to the colleges that will be getting less money because of the new formula. That might include a one-time award to help with the transition.
Former President Donald Trump has been indicted yet again on 7 counts. They include obstruction and conspiracy related to the classified documents he kept in a closet at Mar-a-Lago. The judge in his case issued rulings favorable to Trump last year and expressed repeated skepticism of Justice Department positions. The assignment of U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon was confirmed today. Cannon was broadly criticized last year for granting the Trump legal team's request for a special master to conduct an independent review of the hundreds of classified documents seized from Trump's Florida property last year. That move temporarily halted key aspects of the Justice Department's investigative work. It was overturned months later by a 3-judge federal appeals court panel. Trump's indictment was over alleged hoarding of documents with strong national security implications, carries potential grave legal consequences, including prison time. It also has serious political implications. Experts wonder if Republican voters and party leaders will stick with a now twice indicted candidate. The indictment includes 7 criminal charges. Within minutes of its announcement, Trump began fundraising off of it for his presidential campaign. He repeated his familiar refrain that the investigation is a witch hunt. Trump has already been indicted in New York and faces additional investigations in Washington and Atlanta that could also lead to criminal charges. The indictment comes from a months-long investigation whether Trump broke the law by holding on to hundreds of documents marked classified at his Palm Beach property, Mar-a-Lago. It also asks whether Trump tried to obstruct the government's efforts to recover the records.
The United States Supreme Court handed down a ruling yesterday that surprised court watchers. It upheld the Voting Rights Act and struck down an Alabama redistricting map as illegal racial gerrymandering. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Brett Kavanaugh joined the 3 liberal justices to rule against Alabama's congressional map in a 5-4 decision. Alabama has 7 congressional seats, and 25% of voters are black. Their Republican-dominated state legislature drew a districting map that only created 1 majority black district. It's a tactic called packing, where districts are drawn to pack all the members of a certain group into 1 district so they can't create a majority elsewhere. The court ruled that the legislature denied African American voters a reasonable chance to elect a second representative of their choice. It's a decision that could have implications for other states, especially in the South, where extreme racial gerrymandering was part of the push to create the Voting Rights Act in the first place. The decision is a bit surprising because of the court's recent record on the Voting Rights Act and the conservative majority. The outcome for Alabama likely means the creation of a second majority black congressional district, a second black member of Congress from Alabama, and potentially a second Democrat.
The Supreme Court renders a surprising decision. The Environmental Protection Agency is not helping some states, and President Biden calls for more LGBTQ protections. With those stories and more, it's Edwin Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We looked at the history and traditions of the Constitution, at what the framers and the founders thought about. And when I drilled down to that level of analysis, it became clear to me that the framers themselves adopted the Equal Protection Clause, the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment in a race-conscious way.
U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson spoke during oral arguments in a case over whether a congressional redistricting map in Alabama violated the Voting Rights Act. In a 5-4 decision, the High Court ruled the map must be redrawn, upholding a precedent saying states must create the maximum number of majority or near-majority black congressional districts where voting is racially polarized. In a dissenting opinion, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote the ruling amounts to what he called racial entitlement, not permitted in the Constitution or in law. As states across the East Coast deal with smoke from Canadian wildfires causing health problems for residents with breathing issues, further challenges lie ahead. Some states will need to petition the EPA for an exceptional event to avoid penalties for violating federal air quality standards. Russell Dickerson with the University of Maryland says the EPA could possibly find afflicted states responsible.
We're going to be in trouble with the EPA because these are violations. So it'll go to court to decide, are they going to blame the states? Because the states have the responsibility for fixing their air quality problems to a large extent. And these are violations. They're going to put us over the top.
In the wake of several states passing laws banning gender-affirming care, regulating restroom use, and restricting participation in girls' sports, President Joe Biden announced a series of new initiatives will be implemented to protect LGBTQ+ Americans from discrimination. Along with a new coordinator to protect LGBTQ students from book bans, he called on Congress to pass the Equality Act.
We're going to strengthen the physical safety, dedicated resources to federal coordination of Better Protect Pride celebrations, marches, community centers, healthcare providers, and small businesses.
A new wealth-building program will be available in a few north-central states for black residents descended from slaves. The Open Road Fund, created from a $50 million donation from the Bush Foundation, will offer grants of $50,000 to at least 800 eligible applicants. Danielle M. Colley with the group Nexus Community Partners says the fund will help people who've dealt with institutional barriers to build a better sense of well-being.
It might mean that you'll be able to put a down payment on a home so that you don't have the stress of unstable housing any longer. It might mean that you are able to invest in education and you can finish that degree that maybe you've been putting off.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Next week, Portland police drones will be taking flight for the first time. It's part of a pilot program to get a better look at crashing crime scene investigations. Police say they won't use the drones to surveil citizens. They've bought 8 drones so far, and 16 officers have been trained to use them. Police say they'd like to use the drones to get aerial photography of crashes and crime scenes to help stitch together and reconstruct scenes to speed up investigations. Oregon law puts limits on how unmanned aerial devices like drones can be used. Law enforcement agencies need to get a warrant to use them in most cases. They don't need a warrant to use them for investigating crashes or crime scenes, helping with search and rescue or public emergencies, or in exigent circumstances. For that, you might think of a bombing or a hostage situation. After the year-long pilot program is over, the police bureau will report data and general conclusions to the city council. But police say it's unlikely they will stop using the technology.
The downtown Portland apartments that burned in a major fire last month will be demolished, the city said today. There is no set date for tearing down the structure, but it has an emergency authorization. The building is located at 14th and Southwest Taylor, and the area has been blocked off since. The worry is that more of the damaged structure could collapse. The street has been closed since May 16th. The only demolition and only demolition contractors can enter the building to try to gather former occupants' belongings. The building next door, Maxwell Hall, is also considered uninhabitable because of the fire. During the firefighting efforts, the building got some serious smoke and water damage. That building will be restored, though, instead of demolished. One of the burn building residents, Garrett Rep, was arrested for suspicion of starting the fire in his own apartment on the third floor. Rep has been evicted, and Multnomah County Sheriff's officers were scheduled to remove him from the apartment just an hour after he allegedly started the fire. Earlier this week, he was indicted on 55 counts, including 28 counts of arson and 21 counts of reckless endangerment.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek won't ask for an extra 50-cent tax on bottles of alcohol after all. In her February budget, Kotek asked for an extra tax from the OLCC to help fund mental health and addiction services. This week, she sent an updated letter to the board saying it's no longer needed. New revenue forecasts show that the 4 bits per bottle aren't needed to fund the services she has in mind. The state budget is one of the major legislative items being held up by the Republican walkout from the state Senate. The session has to end June 25th, and Kotek has said that she might call an emergency session to pass the budget if lawmakers can't get back to work before then.
A drag queen story time planned at the Tigard Public Library for Sunday is canceled due to threats of violence. Officials say they'll shut down the library for the day as a precaution. The source of the threats has not been confirmed by official sources, but a planned sit-in protest and counter-protest have circulated on social media. The event was sponsored by the City of Tigard for Pride Month. It would have featured well-known Portland drag queen Poison Waters.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, with an in-depth report on weaponizing drug laws against black and brown persons from the media watch group FAIR. At 6, it's the Magical Mystery Tour. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will show more showers, with cloudy conditions overnight. The low will be 54. Tomorrow's weather will be partly to mostly cloudy. The high will be 76. Today in history, in the year 0068, Roman Emperor Nero died while Rome burned. Contrary to the classic teaching, there is no actual evidence he was fiddling at the time. The quote of the day is from Nero, who said, "Hidden talents count for nothing."
South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem is joining a conservative boycott effort against retail giant Target. Target is taking fire because of donations the company made to a Native-led nonprofit. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem is piling on to conservative backlash against the retail giant Target over its Pride collection, including tuck-friendly swimwear. And as South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger reports, she's criticizing the company for donating to a Native-led nonprofit.
Governor Noem is joining calls to boycott the company by pointing to donation it has made to Indian Collective, a social justice organization in Rapid City that calls for returning the Black Hills to the Lakota. In an appearance on Fox and Friends Wednesday morning, Noem said the group is anti-American.
And this is a very extreme organization that's raising these dollars from nonprofits such as Target and going forward and buying land and using it to infiltrate our American way of life and our value system.
Noem says the group wants to shut down Mount Rushmore.
It's kind of madness that we're in this era that efforts to fight for social justice are being villainized.
That's Nick Tilson, the president of Indian Collective, the group Noem is criticizing. He says Mount Rushmore is a symbol used to obscure indigenous history in the United States.
If we're going to achieve racial justice and a reckoning and a healing in this country, the only way to do that is to tell the true history of this country. And I think that in the future, Mount Rushmore could be a place that happens.
Target Corporation has not returned requests for comment. 24 hours after Noem's appearance on Fox and Friends, the term-limited governor sent out a message through a Republican fundraising text bank linking to her political action committee. I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
Alaska is mourning the loss of an Inupiaq artist who wanted to leave a legacy for future generations. To learn about the history and culture of Alaska Natives, as KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, he leaves behind many contemporary art fans who loved his carvings, sculptures, and paintings.
Joe Sinungatuk was born in Wales into a traditional Inupiaq life of hunting and fishing. He later studied art at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the San Francisco Arts Institute. As a young man, Sinungatuk fought against producing commercial art aimed at tourists, which at the time was the only market available for Native artists. Instead, he used his art to tell stories about his Inupiaq culture and its struggles to survive in a modern world. His wife Martha says his pieces weren't always pretty, but they had a lot to say.
There's boards of people that just want to make pretty paintings. I know he is one of a kind that could not just create something that people admired, but something that will last for hundreds of years.
Sinungatuk was a student of indigenous art the world over. In an interview with Alaska Public Media's Lori Townsend, he said the ancestors of Native peoples used art to tell stories.
The original purpose of them were to give birth to an idea, to a dance, to a ceremony that would celebrate a new life.
Most recently, Sinungatuk was an elder in residence at Alaska Pacific University, where you could often find him carving and talking with students about Native culture. Sinungatuk said his culture was inspiration for all his work, and although his life was far from smooth, he once said cutting into soft wood with a sharp blade felt like a knife sliding through butter, a feeling he enjoyed all his life. I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Canadian wildfires are harming humans and wildlife alike out east. And expert predicts we will see more of them. Edwin J. Vieira is back with more on the story.
As smoke from Canadian wildfires blankets New York and much of the East Coast, it's causing a wide range of health effects, and not just for people. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, they can be as minor as eye and respiratory tract irritation to worsening asthma and even causing heart failure. And humans aren't the only ones feeling the effects of smoky skies. Wildlife is compromised through loss of habitat, food, and water sources. Karina Newsom with the National Wildlife Federation notes climate change could make this a regular occurrence.
With there being more frequent, more intense, longer burning wildfires, and of course, natural movement of air, we can absolutely expect to see wildfire smoke occurring in places where maybe wildfires are not actually burning, like we're seeing right now, being a more frequent experience.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul has ordered New York firefighters to help combat the Canadian blazes. As for the Belmont Stakes this weekend, Hochul says she's taking additional measures to protect racehorses and spectators, adding if the air quality hits 200, the race will be canceled. Some states dealing with the smoke will need to petition the EPA for what is known as an exceptional event. It's the term for an unusual occurrence that affects air quality and cannot be reasonably controlled using traditional methods. Otherwise, Dr. Russell Dickerson with the University of Maryland says the EPA could possibly make states like New York and New Jersey responsible for air quality violations.
We're going to be in trouble with the EPA because these are violations. So it'll go to court to decide, are they going to blame the states? Because the states have the responsibility for fixing their air quality problems to a large extent. And these are violations. They're going to put us over the top.
The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee held a hearing on the impacts of escalating wildfires. A spokesman for the Interior Department said the bipartisan infrastructure law can help the U.S. deal with these kinds of blazes in the future. It provides over $1.5 billion for wildland fire research to help with risk reduction. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
With children out of school for the summer, their parents and caregivers can help them develop skills, so they'll have a better school experience once classes start again in the fall. Farah Siddiqui explains how.
Tasks like packing a suitcase for summer travel may be difficult for some Illinois children. Experts say parents and caregivers can help kids over the summer with the skills known as executive functions. Adults can be alert to a child's difficulties with their ability to adjust thinking and stay on task, as well as impulse control. Katie Gleason with the YWCA Metropolitan Chicago says there's plenty that can be done during the summer months to help prepare children for the next school year, and that doesn't mean assigning homework.
If
playbake. It's relationships. It's routine. Another thing is making sure we're breaking down big tasks into smaller steps. Working on a puzzle, you can help them identify the steps.
Gleason says rapid growth in executive function skills for children takes place from ages 3 to 5, and then again in adolescence and early adulthood. Gleason says the Y is one place to learn more about EF and what adults can do to encourage these skills. An air traffic control system at a busy airport is how Harvard Center for the Developing Child refers to EF skills, and it says they are critical to healthy development. Gleason agrees and cautions parents and caregivers not to blame a child for poor behavior when it may be connected to what is developmentally appropriate.
And if we shift our way of thinking and saying, oh, this child can't do this, instead we need to be thinking as adults and as education and care systems, what are we doing to help the child develop?
Reflection Sciences offers a play-based screening tool to assess levels of executive function skills in children. The results can help parents and teachers follow up with strategies that are tailored to their child's development level. For Illinois News Connection, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
Two new drugs look promising in Alzheimer's disease. Mark Moran fills us in with the Iowa News Service.
As part of Alzheimer's and Brain Awareness Month, mental health advocates in Iowa are sharing information about Alzheimer's and say two new drugs show promise in treating it. It is important to point out that while treatments are improving, there is no cure for Alzheimer's. As the population of older Americans continues to grow, the number of Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia is on the rise. By 2050, the number of seniors 65 and older with Alzheimer's is projected to double to nearly 13 million. Lauren Livingston with the Alzheimer's Association Iowa chapter says the state numbers reflect the national trend.
In Iowa, there are 66,000 people or more affected by the disease, and there are almost 100,000 caregivers across the state. So it affects so many people.
Livingston says higher wages for dementia-centered healthcare workers are a primary focus, but adds scientists are excited about two new drugs, Aduhelm and Leqembi, showing promising results in clinical trials. They work by targeting beta amyloid, a plaque-forming protein that disrupts the function of brain cells. Right now, those drugs are only being administered at treatment centers while research continues. The Urbandale Public Library hosts an early-stage dementia workshop today at noon. Livingston says people experiencing the early stages of Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia may start to notice they're not remembering things that used to be second nature, things they've done routinely their entire lives.
Forgetting how to use the microwave or forgetting how to get home from the grocery store, not being able to retrace their steps. Those are some really common signs.
People suffering from Alzheimer's are the first to notice their symptoms, Livingston says, even before other family members, and often react by becoming socially withdrawn for fear of showing an embarrassing memory lapse in public. For Iowa News Service, I'm Mark Moran.
Use by, best before, sell by. What does it all mean anyway? Many consumers find food labels confusing, and it contributes to food waste. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz tells us more with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When you find uncooked food lurking in your fridge, you might throw it out if the date on the package has passed, but perhaps you shouldn't.
There's been a lot of confusion about how to interpret these labels. Like, we call them expiration dates, but they're actually not necessarily expiration dates.
Anjali Narang is a PhD candidate at Cornell University. She says the date does not always indicate food safety. Sometimes it indicates when a product's quality is best. But knowing what's meant is often confusing, because the wording on food labels varies.
There's use by, best of use by, best before, sell by, fresh by. I've even seen just the date.
Narang was part of a team that studied how the wording on these labels affects food waste, which is bad for the climate and consumers' wallets. She found that people were more likely to trash food if the label only had a date on it, or if the label included the word use in any form. For example, best if used by, or simply use by.
So our theory is that people are interpreting these dates as expiration dates.
Even if that's not what's meant. So the study indicates that standardizing food labels could help reduce food waste. But the wording chosen must be clear to consumers. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org. But the wording chosen must be clear to consumers.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 9th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. The co-producers for tonight's newscast are myself, Josh Salem, and Althea Billings, and our engineer is Laura Miller. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mark Moran, Edwin J. Vieira, Farah Siddiqui, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Danny Shy. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, this country has a long history of weaponizing drug laws against black and brown communities. Harry Anslinger, the first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, ran an anti-marijuana crusade in the 1930s, saying, quote,